Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. My name is Fabrizio, and I am very excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it is with ourselves or with others. Across time and culture, stories have been agents of personal transformation, in part because they have the power to change our hearts and minds. The purpose of our weekly calls is to share stories from incredible change makers from around the globe. Through thoughtfully guided conversations with them, our special guest speakers share their personal stories and inspire us through their actions, their experiences, and their insights. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We are thankful to them and to all of our listeners for helping co-create this space. Today, we are grateful to have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Jonathan Rose, whose personal journey is not only inspiring, but has had a tremendous impact on many people. Thanks again for joining today's call, and let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Jonathan Rose. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, REA Cooper-Smith, will engage in a dialogue with our guest, Jonathan, and around the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we'll invite all of your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit star 6 on your phone to be included in that queue. You will be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. This week's theme is well-tempered cities that harmonize humans. Our guest, Jonathan Rose, is a developer and visionary philanthropist who believes we can design and reshape our cities to equalize the landscape of opportunity, enhancing resilience, adaptability, well-being, and harmony with nature. He's recognized for creating urban communities that heal both residents and neighborhoods alike. Our moderator today, REA Cooper-Smith, also helped to create an urban community hub, the legendary House of Love and Prayer that healed residents in a neighborhood of San Francisco in the 1960s. A story which he's chronicled in his book entitled Holy Beggars, A Journey from Hate Street to Jerusalem. He holds an MA in Humanistic Psychology from California State University and has held a variety of leading roles in human resources for decades. He's also the founder of One World Lights, a community of global citizens with the shared vision of people across the globe supporting a course change for humanity by supporting each other. And so I can think of nobody better in the service space ecosystem to interview our guest today. Arye, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Fab, for that generous introduction. Anyway, I am really happy to be able to have this conversation and all of us to have this conversation with Jonathan Rose. He is a real estate developer, urban planner, philanthropist, and author, and he's best known as a developer of affordable, environmentally responsible communities. He's also founder of Gramophone Records, a jazz and new music label. And he is author of the book, The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Behavior Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. This book won the 2017 Prose Award for Outstanding Scholarly Work by a Trade Publisher. Early in life, Jonathan found inspiration for the vision, the idea of well-tempered cities from the music of Johann Sebastian Bach in The Well-Tempered Clavier, and I look forward to exploring that together some more. Jonathan's inspiration from music extends throughout his career. In 1979, he founded Gramophone Records, producing over 75 jazz and new music recordings. And in 1986, he joined with Wynton Marsalis and a leadership group in New York to form Jazz at Lincoln Center, where he was chairman of its executive committee from 1996 to 2003. And he oversaw the design and construction of its home, the Frederick P. Rose Hall, which was named after his father. In 2002, Jonathan and his wife co-founded the Garrison Institute, which connects inner transformation with outer solutions to relieve suffering in the fields of trauma, education, and the environment. He's also served on the boards of the Education Alliance, the Enterprise Community Partners, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and is an honorary board member of the Natural Resources Defense Council and the American Museum of Natural History. In 2007, he was named commission chair of the Green Ribbon Commission of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority in the New York area, and he was member of the governor's 2100 commission formed in 2012 after Hurricane Sandy. So, Jonathan Rose, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us in this conversation this morning.
Good morning. I'm happy to join you.
So I'd like to talk about the well-tempered clavier, which became for you a kind of a seed for your concept of well-tempered cities. Can you share with us about how you see and hear this music and how it became so important for you in your thinking about cities?
Great. So interestingly, it goes back to Pythagoras. So about 2,500 years ago, and interestingly, Pythagoras lived at a time called the Axial Age, which was also the same, about 500 BC, which is when the Buddha lived and when Confucius was writing and Socrates. It was an amazingly generative time in human history. It was actually similar to this time. There had been two inventions. I know I'm going a little long, but we have some time. So.
Oh, we have plenty of time. No problem.
There had been two inventions actually about 500 or 700 years earlier. One was money, and the other was the wheel and the armed chariot. And the chariot led to a vast expansion of war, and the money led to a vast expansion of capitalism and consumerism. And I say that because we're seeing, in a way, a similar situation today. And in response, to, you know, there was like a great kind of social chaos and destruction and suffering that came out of these. And there was, across the world, there seems to have been a collective response that emerged in this Axial Age to that. At any rate, what Pythagoras observed was that the proportion between the notes on a lyre, or a lute, think of it as, were the same as the proportion of the distances between the planets, which is an amazing, you know, with the unaided eye observation. And then he observed that that proportion, which we call the golden...
About pattern recognition.
So he saw that that actually existed throughout nature. And what he said is, if humans are going to do anything in alignment with nature, it should be in this proportion. When you tune instruments to that proportion, it's actually internally perfect. And you get it's the most perfect tuning. So for the next 2,000 years, all musical instruments were tuned that way. The problem is that if you tune instruments in the key of A perfectly, and then you tune other instruments in the key of C, their perfections don't align. They work individually, but not as a whole system. They actually sound terrible if you play them together. So you could never go, you were stuck in just one key. And this was a musical problem for 2,000 years. A mathematician in China around 1500 figured out the answer to this, which is that actually you tune slightly in between perfections. You find a compromise, and that's the space where you can find unity, harmonic unity amongst all these different keys. Actually, if you go back to Pythagoras, his wife was another philosopher named Theano. And she proposed something called the golden mean, which was all about finding these compromises. She said, "The, you know, so interesting that Pythagoras was masculine and she was feminine. They had these two points of view, but she was continually trying to soften his philosophy and find the space where consensus came together, make it less black and white. That is what the Chinese philosopher discovered. May it turn it into math. It came across the Silk Route, entered Europe, and by around just before 1600, a German mathematician named Andreas Weichmeister turned it into a tuning system called temperament. And at the same time, a new instrument was invented, which is the clavier, which is the forerunner to the piano. So the way I view it is that society, or the musical society, had a new operating system, this tuning system, and a new new technology, new hardware. It's a new hardware, new software, which was the clavier, and it completely unleashed Bach. So let's back up. Mm. Bach was a deep religious man who most of his life, almost all of his life, really worked for churches or for courts writing church music. And his goal was to express the extraordinary harmony of the universe on earth in music. But his palate had been limited. I mean, he did amazing, amazing works. But when he came to understand the power of temperament and the new instrument, the clavier, he brought those together and they created this amazing music. To show the world how to use these new tools, he created music, which the Well-Tempered Clavier, in two books. The first book was really an instruction book. It was a series of compositions that showed every major and minor key on the keyboard. And he did these amazingly beautiful pieces. And then 20 years later did book two, which is just a continuation. So I had written, I knew this, and that was a part of my book. I had written my book. I turned it into my publisher, who said, if you really want me to publish this, I'll publish this, but it's not your best book. Take more time, rewrite it, and write your best book. Huh. I need a new organizing theme. And I said, almost instantly, I said, aha, I'm going to organize it around the idea of the Well-Tempered Clavier. As I said, that had been in the book, but it had been a minor theme in the book, and I reorganized.
Interesting. So initially you didn't organize it that way.
Right. So
wow.
That's the book that came out. And it was fantastic because it is a symbol of a human looking to nature, finding patterns of harmony, and trying to express that harmony in human manifestation on earth, and in a way that harmony, when we listen to Bach's music, it is to re-inspire us, it is to reconnect us with that greater harmony. And in the end, and that's with my real aspiration for cities, I recognize that they need infrastructure that works, they need political systems that work, they need livelihoods for all people, that so this has to be very practically grounded. But my sense is that anything we do, although it needs to be practically grounded, rises to the level of our aspiration. And I felt that Bach's aspiration set a very high aspiration as a model for how we should think about the future of human civilization.
You know, one of the things that you were saying that really caught my attention about the development of the modern scale is that you said that the original one developed by Pythagoras was perfect, but the perfect didn't allow for the harmonization of different keys.
Right.
And, you know, it just seems to me that that has so much relation to the situation in our world, in our country, in our societies today, that somehow it seems to me that people want a perfect philosophy or a perfect approach or a perfect political ideology, but that doesn't allow for the harmonization of different groups of people.
Right. So we also, one of the issues we have in society today, certainly in the world of working in cities, is that everything is divided into silos. And this really, so what's interesting is there's a fascinating book called, if you wait 1 second, I'll get you the exact name, but it describes Bach. So there was a meeting between Bach and Frederick the Great, and it happened about 1750, just before Bach died. And it is this story, and it's called An Evening in the Palace of Reason. And Frederick the Great was a despotic king, but he also kind of was very enthusiastic about the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment said that reason matters, and Bach came from this deeper spiritual world where there was a kind of a pre-reason approach. From 750 on, the world became much, much more reasonable. We focused much more on logical systems, on organization. It unleashed the Industrial Revolution. It gave rise to all kinds of progress, but we lost an enormous amount of integration that came with it. And ultimately, what flowed out of the Enlightenment was dividing things into pieces. That's really how science prospered, breaking things down rather than reintegrating them through the 19th and early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And our city agencies and our funding happened that way. So we funded highways out of the transportation department and housing out of the housing department, and we set policy for schools out of education and health out of the health department. And we broke them apart when actually they are all deeply interrelated. And what you're seeing with the rise of complexity theory and systems thinking is at the beginnings of an understanding that we have to reintegrate. And I think if we're going to succeed in the 21st century, it's going to be understanding how we reintegrate the pieces back into wholes.
Mm. And that's really a key theme in your book. There's one place where you talk about to increase urban adaptability in a way that balances prosperity and well-being with efficiency and equity, ever moving toward wholeness. And you say that the five qualities of a city that can do this are coherence, circularity, resilience, community, and compassion. Can you say, without going into a huge amount of detail, can you say a little bit about that? What are those qualities, and how does that bring cities into a state of wholeness?
So first, just a warning, and that is, unfortunately, I'm not sure they ever reach a perfect state of wholeness, but we need to be moving toward, because we're in dynamic systems, you know, like there's no static end state, so it's like something you have to endlessly be moving towards. I hope we get there, but at least be good to be a whole lot closer. So the first is coherence, and the importance of coherence is it's really what I was just saying about master planning. It's about how we actually need to reintegrate all of our systems. And in that section, I actually begin looking at the very beginning of civilization and history. And because my question was, how did cities arise? I mean, where did this phenomena come from? And one of the interesting lessons is the oldest building known in the world is an incredible temple in southern Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. And it, so it's amazing. The first building we know wasn't a hut. I know we know people lived in caves and they probably lived in thatched houses and stuff, but it's not a hut or a little village. It's an amazing temple. It's a big temple. It has huge stones that are carved with half man and half beast that people believe took 500 people to move, and there were vast ceremonies that took place. The temple was actually the joint point between humans, heaven and earth, between humans and nature. And there's an archaeologist named Klaus Schulze who says, first came the temple, then came the city. In the roots of every ancient city, we see, if you dig down to the lowest level, a temple. Okay, so coherence was actually part of the a very interesting thing is coherence and there's differentiation. I draw a lot of analogies from nature and a lot from the nature of the mind. The scientist Dan Siegel says, the healthy mind integrates differentiated parts, and so must the healthy city. So coherence is really about how in a dynamic, ever-changing world do you create coherence moving towards an integrative goal. The next thing,
so what's fascinating about that ancient cities you're describing is that it was built on a sort of religious, mystical, spiritual vision, and that's so different from how we experience secular cities today.
Yes. By the way, the Chinese cities, so it's different in different parts of the world. the Chinese cities were also extremely organized around an amazing pattern called the Nine Square Pattern, in which they actually mapped it on all of China. So at the city level, there were these nine squares. The center square was always the Emperor's Square, and one square was the Market Square, and one square was the Administrative Square, and so on. And then if you go beyond the city to the county worked that way. If you even go to the farmer's field, the farmer's fields were divided into nine squares. Mm. And the center square was the crops they raised was tithed to go to the emperor. Because remember, that's where the emperor lived in the ultimate, you know, ruling city.
Wow.
The food that came from that square would go to a county center. The county center was designed in nine squares, and the food would go to the warehouse in the center ninth square, and then that would go to the region. So they had this complete coherence of maybe over coherence, but anyway, they had this complete system design based on these nine squares that mapped every part of the country.
Amazing.
Okay, so the next section is circularity. So 98% of everything that goes into cities leaves as waste within 6 months. By 2050, we're going to be a population of 10 billion people. And by 2080, they think 80% of the world's population will be living in cities. And we already consume far more than the Earth can sustain. And the 10 billion people are becoming more and more middle class, which is good, but it also means that they are consuming even more. It's completely unsustainable. And so the only solution is we have to move from linear usage to circular usage. So, for example, many parts of the world are developing enormous droughts. They really don't have enough water. We have to be recycling wastewater back into drinking water, which is very achievable. We have to be recycling. San Francisco has the highest rate of recycling in the world.
It recycles
80% of its waste and has a goal, I think, by 2022 or something like that, to be recycling 100% of its waste. Interestingly, its waste recycling is done by a co-op that actually came out of a early 20th century rag pickers union. So it's creating great jobs, too, locally. So we need to recycle. We need to think of everything in circular ways. We actually, and I'll get into this a little bit later, I have a friend named John Fullerton who has asked, what is a regenerative economy that is also not linear but is circular? So we need to think about how we integrate all those elements in a circular system, which is what nature does. What's interesting is the way nature does this. So think about it. Trees breathe out oxygen and in carbon dioxide. Humans breathe in oxygen and out carbon dioxide. We cycle together, and even as elementary school kids, I think we learned about the incredible, or junior high school kids, the incredible cycles of nature. How does that happen? It happens because we all share the same DNA. You may have heard that humans and banana trees have 50% of the same DNA, and humans and frogs have 92% of the DNA. It is that metagenome, it is that vast genomic system that actually integrates us all, that kind of gives us each our own piece of the instructions, but the instructions are all tied together. And so now you can begin to see how coherence and using kind of really deep integration and planning leads to the circularity, which is the whole system's functioning together. We're in a much more volatile time in the 21st century. We know from climate change we're going to have enormous weather volatility. We're seeing certainly political volatility, and we're seeing wars and the largest number of refugees that we've had in a long time. We need to think about how we create much more resilient systems. So the third section is how we create resilient systems, and some of that is from technical systems, such as microgrids and solar, alternative energy, and how we tie all those technologies together. But it's also about weaving natural infrastructure, weaving nature into cities. There's a vast human desire to be next. It's called biophilia, to be part of nature. And we're seeing the best cities in the world are actually becoming much taller, much denser, but at the same time opening up space for nature. That sounds like a conflict, but for example, in Singapore, the minimum building now is 50 stories tall for new buildings. The
minimum building, is that building code?
That is code.
Oh my God.
But those buildings are mixed use, they're mixed income, they're mixed race. They've had racial riots in the 70s to solve it by having everybody live together. And then the space, then they're creating much more space. They're actually ripping up roads and turning them into incredible biodiversity parks.
So do you have a design where you have tall buildings and then parks in between them? Is it like that?
Well, they're not in between them, but the buildings are clustered to be communities, and then woven as a fabric around and through them are parks.
Ah.
So, at any rate, we have to basically integrate circular technical systems and natural systems. Nature is an amazingly effective tool for climate change. So communities that have that are very enriched with trees, for example, are 6 degrees cooler in the summer. The trees absorb air pollution. The trees absorb carbon, so actually they're helping solve the carbon problem. The trees provide natural shading. The trees, we now know that neighborhoods with a lot of trees have better mental health. People walk more and have better physical health. Neighborhoods with a lot of trees have higher real estate values, which is better for homeowners and generates more taxes, so it's better for cities. These are all these what we call co-benefits that come from bringing nature into cities. And one of the solutions, again, of circularity is you're always looking for co-benefits, for this integration that takes us back to the well temperament. The fourth section is called resilience. So it's how you begin to tie all the... I'm sorry, that's the resilience section. Yeah. The fourth section is called community.
Yeah.
So community is then how do you create human communities that function along these principles? And one of the things I've created is a phrase called the cognitive ecology, recognizing that that our minds together, we call it culture, but our minds, there's a lot of social science now about how we co-influence each other. Science, for example, that shows that if somebody becomes obese, that then their spouse and other people close to them are likely to be obese, and it actually goes through three links of interconnection. There's vast studies over multiple generations that show how disease and health can spread through social relations. One of the key things corroding our cognitive ecology is trauma. We're an increasingly traumatized society, and early childhood trauma, when children experience abuse, neglect, a lot of volatility, parents going off to jail, parents being divorced, eviction that comes from financial issues, etc., that these have lifelong consequences in how these young children then as young adults and adults behave, and lifelong consequences in terms of their health. There's a huge amount of healing that needs to be done in our mental states if we're going to truly have a healthy cognitive ecology, which is an essential part of the total ecology of cities.
So how does design of a city impact cognitive ecology? How does that work?
So I'll give you some specific examples. You have to think it's design alone. So we're designing not just physical space. We have to design. I'm going to give you an example. I want to go to a key to this. So part of this problem is that we now face huge income inequality in America, and the inequality is not just income. We now know that if you look at the healthiest zip code, statistically people have a 20-year longer lifespan than the least healthy zip code.
Wow.
We know that the education is very poorly distributed. We know that access to affordable housing is poorly distributed. And we can look at all, there's a whole bunch of functions that we can look in their distribution. And if we set a goal, that the true mission for America is to be a land of opportunity, And that our goal then is to equalize this landscape of opportunity for all. And then we ask, how do we design communities to provide this equal opportunity? Then what we see is every neighborhood must have housing that is affordable for the people who live and work there. Every neighborhood must have schools that are attuned to the needs of their specific population, so that every child growing up in America and in the world has equal opportunity to education, that the healthcare system is distributed. I'll give you some examples of this. That parks and open space, which I described how important they are, equally distributed.
Yeah.
That there's mass transit and walkability, that there's local shopping, that there's healthy food. We now know there's not only a whole series of items, but we can actually measure them. So, for example, in New Orleans, all poor people before Katrina could only go to one hospital, which is called the Charity Hospital. It was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina. And when the plan came to rebuild it, the hospital was not rebuilt. It was rebuilt as 81 community-based clinics. One of the major diseases of the poorest people in New Orleans was diabetes, and they often had to go for dialysis. So instead of going to one central place where you had to wait in line all day, and it was a horrible place, this charity hospital, they now go to locally based community clinics, which is much easier, but more important, equally importantly, they've trained in these 81 neighborhoods local people to be dialysis technicians and to be healthcare workers. So you now have not only distributed the work, you've distributed the opportunity and the training, but you have people who know their neighbors who are serving as the technicians. So that's just one example where, you know, I can go through all the city systems that we need.
Right.
To
so this example of the distributed clinics employing local people, this is relating to your quality of community.
Well, so this is all within this issue of how you create healthy communities. So to me, then we need communities that both, you know, bring more nature back into neighborhoods, but also bring opportunity to neighborhoods. And the opportunity, so that distribution I described about health has to happen at the level also of education, as I said, transportation, all the aspects of a city need to be more equally distributed.
Right.
The last section is called compassion. And I think it's really in alignment with your audience and your audience's mission, that we can't achieve any of this unless we have a pervading sense of compassion and action. And that's really dependent upon two things. The first is we have to really understand that we are deeply interdependent, that all of nature and all of life is interconnected. And then secondly, we have to infuse that understanding of interdependence with both individual acts of compassion, but also understand that we need systems of compassion and that we need to, in effect, think about how do we design systems that enhance the quality of life and equalize it for every single resident in the city. And with that view, which I call entwinement, the understanding of systems with the desire to equalize all and spread compassion, that I call entwinement. And I think that worldview is essential for the ultimate health of cities.
Wow, thank you for that. A really comprehensive a view of what is and what's needed. I think at this point, I would like to remind our listeners that we'd love to have your questions in about a half hour. If you're on the phone, you can dial *6 and be in the queue. And if you're streaming online, you can fill out the form on the page there or email to ask@ servicespace.org. Jonathan, I want to sort of transition from the view, the intellectual structure that you've laid out for us, and ask you about your development business. Can you Can you make it a little concrete for us, you know, a project that you've done that that embodies some of these qualities or moves the community towards some of these qualities, and, you know, actually give us an idea of how this works on the ground?
Great. Okay, so one of the most interesting, in a way, ordinarily achievable things we're doing is we've raised a series of funds that buy existing affordable housing, make it greener, and bring these elements of community of opportunity to them. So I'm going to tell you, we do some amazing new things. We build incredible new buildings. They're beautiful, and they're green, and they have all these fantastic elements integrated in them. They're hard to do. They take, you know, 5 to 7 years. They're fantastic, but we can't really do that at scale. But what we can do is transform existing affordable housing at scale, and we've created a model for that. So first of all, every time we buy a project, think of a 200-unit affordable housing project built in the 1970s or late 70s, early 80s. If they're taller, they're kind of these concrete block kind of foreboding-looking buildings, and if they're lower rise, they're kind of suburban, scattered site, kind of often brownish, you know, three-story, walk-up-y kind of suburban-y affordable housing cluster. So very ordinary stuff.
Uh-huh.
So the first thing is I actually many years ago helped an amazing group called Enterprise Community Partners, which is a combination of a for-profit and not-for-profit totally dedicated to social enterprise and in affordable housing. It brings about $7 billion of funding to communities to do transformation. Is working in the San Francisco Bay Area, amongst others, works all over the country. And we created a green guideline called Enterprise Green Communities. Many of you have probably heard of LEED or the Living Building Challenge. Enterprise Green Community Guideline is designed specifically for affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
And we retrofit all of our buildings to it. It typically lowers our energy use by 20 to 40%, our water use by 15 to 25%, our greenhouse gases. And we focus a lot on non-toxic, so it creates much healthier indoor air quality for the residents. So we do that renovation. By the way, it's very simple. It's not, you know, we do solar, wind, it makes economic sense, but we're doing things like better insulation and caulking and putting in variable speed, variable drive motors and more efficient boilers and in some cases better windows. And it's very normal technologies. So we're greening the buildings. And then we have a package that we have found works. We're still experimenting. We have a vast experiment going on with this. But we're always trying to see what's the most affordable and therefore duplicatable by others in transformational. So this package, affordable housing always has a community room and a kitchen. So we focus on, first on the health side, we'll build an on-site health exam room. And what we have found is that low-income people are huge users of hospital emergency rooms, which is very expensive, and it's not a good use of a hospital emergency room. So local health care providers are happy. If we build the room, they'll come and provide free on-site health care.
Really?
Yes, because
Do they do that?
Because, first of all, most of it gets reimbursed by Medicaid and Medicare. Huh. And the parts that don't, for low-income people, and the part in low-income seniors, and the parts that don't is still so much cheaper than seeing preventing illness in the home versus, or the apartment building, versus seeing in the emergency room. The second thing is that working with them, we're developing a prescription that is a mixture of medicine, diet, exercise, and meditation.
Hmm.
So that we know that, you know, like if you have high cholesterol or whatever, you know, you can take Lipitor, but that's insufficient. It works so much better when. So the second thing we're building in our projects are exercise rooms. The third thing is community gardens, so that we can create a culture of health, and so that the healthcare providers can do this multi-part prescription. They go like, we want you to ride the exercise bike, you know, 4 days a week for at least 20 minutes a day, and I want you to eat, you know, twice as many salads and stuff. And the project can actually provide that.
Wow!
So we're doing that on the health side.
How do the community gardens operate? Is that just kind of left up to the residents, or is there someone there to provide some guidance in how to do that?
So it depends on the project. Again, we're learning this. This is an initiative we've just been starting. I mean, it's really we've been doing parts of this in community gardens for decades, but this really whole integrated system, we're just really working on now. So it's resident led, and sometimes we bring in a not for profit that helps organize it. So then the next part is education.
Uh-huh.
So many low-income families, particularly children, more and more schools, homework is done online and assignments are delivered online, and kids don't have access to computers. So we're building computer rooms that can function as classrooms. There are many communities, the YMCA or others, provide after-school education, but so if we provide the facility, then they'll provide the teachers, or we also use parents as volunteers for homework help. So there's a place for homework, and then for kids, it's also a place where parents who don't have access to computers can use it for job searching, whatever. We provide, as I said, there's a community room. We try and grow community activities because social connection is so important. And a place for actually social service consulting, where we help families kind of find pathways, connect them to other services that can help. This expands them. So, for example, what we've discovered is we'll work with local libraries that will do, when the health system discovers that a woman is pregnant, then we bring in the library that teaches the mother how to read to kids and gives them starter books. I mean, there's in our best cases now, we're working with 20 or 30 different community groups, which we're all weaving together in a fabric. These are all existing programs, but weaving them into the fabric of the existing building. So here's the point. This is, as much as I imagine an incredible, vast, new, extraordinary, green city permeated by nature with super transportation systems, and hope we get there, I also believe we have to begin this work right here, right now, with the stuff we have.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, thank you. That really helps me envision how this, how this path happens. I want to switch a little bit here, and we've been talking about outer transformation. And I want to sort of ask you a little bit about the inner transformation part of all of this. I noticed in Wikipedia that you describe yourself as both Jewish and Buddhist, and you say, I think Buddhism has really advanced the science of the mind, and Judaism has advanced the process of generosity. And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but I'd like to ask you about your own spiritual practice today and any thoughts about how the inner work and the outer work is connected.
Great. I deeply believe the inner and the outer are connected. Obviously, the nature of how we think and what our worldview is and what we want to achieve in the world affects what our goals are in the world, affect what we create in the world. The world's great spiritual traditions have a sense of the beauty and deep interconnectedness of the world, and they also all have messages about compassionate action. And so those are great resources. It doesn't have to come from those traditions. His Holiness the Dalai Lama proposes something that he calls secular ethics. So it doesn't have to be religious. It can come from the secular world. But I believe that connection of inner and outer is essential. So about, as you noted, in 2002, through an interesting circumstance, my wife and I were given a monastery on the Hudson River, about an hour north of New York City, and surrounded by woods and walking distance to a train and overlooking the river. And we asked the question, what is the monastery of the 21st century? And we said it's a place of deep retreat where people can really connect with their inner spiritual life. But it's also a place of outer action that then shows a pathway to take that inner and kinetic connect it to action in the world.
So how does that work? Can you tell us a little bit about the Garrison Institute and how does the connection between the inner and the outer work there?
So I'll give you an example. My wife was the founding president and ran it for the first 10 years. And very early on, what she noticed was people coming on retreat often were in the social services. They were, you know, social workers or schools working in city schools or nurses, etc., and that they were really burnt out. And they said the work in the world, the compassionate work in the world, was very tough on them. And this led to her developing a program called Caring for the Caregivers, which ended up having several manifestations. She co-developed this with Sharon Salzberg, who's a board member and very active at the Garrison Institute. And they put together, in working with scientists and neuroscientists and social scientists, they put together a program initially for women working in domestic violence shelters. But there's an enormous amount of what's called vicarious trauma, where out of compassion, out of empathy, the women take on the suffering of their clients. And they figured out a way to heal that with a combination of meditation and yoga, because trauma is embodied, and cognitive behavioral therapy and social network building, and a whole pattern of things that proved to be very effective. That program is now, they're now running it in refugee camps around the world.
Wow.
For humanitarian aid workers.
That's beautiful. You've been talking about compassion and you've been talking about empathy. Can you talk about the difference between the two?
So this is really interesting. A scientist named Tanya Singer, who works at the Max Planck, a neuroscientist at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, did an interesting study with a monk named Mathieu Ricard. And what she discovered was that when you do MRI studies, that empathy, where I deeply feel for you, feel with you, I feel your suffering, I feel your pain, lights up the parts of the certain parts of the brain that actually lead to distress. It's called empathetic distress. And that when you focus on compassion, which is I feel for you and I act for you, but I am not you, I do not take on your suffering, leads to an entirely different neural pattern in the brain, and actually leads people to feel gratified in their work. And we have learned, we can actually, Tanya's expanded this on vastly more studies. If you Google Tanya Singer Science Magazine, Empathy and Compassion, an article comes up that describes this work. The work at the Garrison Institute is based on training empathetic people how to shift their empathy to compassion.
That is interesting. So do you follow people who go through this? Have you had stories about how burned out people work at making this shift?
Yes, and what's really interesting is, so we also developed a program that's led by somebody named Tish Jennings called CARE, which is Cultivating Awareness and Resilience in Educators. So it's a version of this compassion training for teachers in working in inner city schools. Tish ran the program for 3 years. We partnered with Penn State University in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and then we did a follow-up three-year study funded by the Federal Department of Administration in the Bronx, and it's proven to be incredibly effective. Tish moved on to University of Virginia and combined the CARE program with other programs, and they now have a program called the Compassionate Schools Program. And I actually visited on my book tour because Louisville, Kentucky, has pledged to not only be a compassionate city, but to have compassionate schools. And they're using this whole integrated system. It's a fantastic integrated system for teachers and students and the staff who work in schools. It gives them a whole language and culture, and it's just working beautifully.
Interesting. So I want to, I guess if... Is the Garrison Institute only for caregivers, social workers, nurses, et cetera? Is it, are there programs that are available for anyone? If someone in our community wants to get involved, how might that happen?
Oh, there are all kinds of ways to get involved. So first of all, yes, we have, if you go to our website, which is www.garrisoninstitute.org, there are there are retreats every weekend of all kinds. Almost all of them are open to the general public, and in many different faiths. So the ones from the Vedanta tradition, the Christian tradition, the Jewish tradition, the Buddhist tradition. And we welcome all kinds of people to come. And then there are programs also specifically, like every summer there's that care training for teachers that I described. Then there are specific ones more for specific sectors. There are some more private ones that people hold. So I run one, for example, for a network of people working in the affordable housing industry, leaders, on that issue of compassion and empathy. So there are many private ones, and many organizations come to the Institute to host their own retreats. We love to welcome that, that too, many not-for-profits and even some for-profits. And then in New York City, if you happen to be in New York on November 29th, we're having our annual fundraising gala, which will be a fantastic event, and you can find out more about that on the website and come and support us that way.
All right, great. Yeah, well, we'll make sure when we send out the email after the call that we'll make sure that people have that that link to the Garrison Institute. You know, thinking about this whole very large systems view that you offer about cities, one question that occurs to me is how can ordinary people who are not real estate developers or, you know, in running big organizations, how can ordinary people participate in the process of evolving, creating well-tempered cities?
Great question. So there are so many interesting community-based organizations and community-based movements now. So I would really encourage you to get involved in your neighborhood. You know, it does. You can get involved at any level. By the way, run for office. Take your good intentions and make it part of public service. So, you know, run for your school board, run for your town council, run for your city council, whatever it is. But also, there are a lot of interesting community groups that are working on. So there's an eco-cities movement. There's something called 2030 districts. There are, I'm blanking the name, it's something like, it's not renewal cities, but something like that. There are so many groups of people where there are, you know, there are people doing community gardens. There are volunteer and mentor at a school. There are, you know, there's so many places to start and do the one that most fits your nature and then grow. And it can be at the community level, but also our cities need volunteer leadership. They really, really do. So run for office.
That's a great answer. And, you know, I love that view because any of us can do that. We can find something. And so you're saying that any of us who volunteer to serve in some way are really part of building a well-tempered city.
Absolutely. And then what's interesting, and this is something that maybe Service Space can help support, is networking. I mean, what I have found is when you can do it in collaboration with others and share ideas and become part of a community that is all working in the same towards the same goals. So there are networks. There are lots and lots of networks of good to become part of. So, for example, if you're involved in community gardens, there's a National Community Garden Network and Regional Community Garden Networks. So not only do the work yourself, but figure out how to connect it to a larger movement.
Got it.
I will just jump in here, Aria, and this is Fabrizio. I will jump in and let people know that if you do have questions for Jonathan, hit *6 on your phone, and you will be added to the queue.
Thank you, Fab. And I've really just got one more question for this part for me, Jonathan, kind of quirky, but, you know, you're talking about cities as ecosystems. And where I live, and where a few of us on the call live in the Bay Area, you know, we relate more to the Bay Area as an ecosystem. There are, you know, there's San Francisco, and then there's San Jose, and then there's smaller cities and smaller communities such as the one we live in. And a lot of the conversation that happens here is around the Bay Area rather than any particular city. And you know, there's the county level, and there are intergovernmental organizations and inter-county organizations and so on. So I'm curious, you know, how about a region? Is a region the same as a city? Is it different? You know, what are the similarities and what are the differences?
So actually, region is the right area, not city. And the reason I use city is just because it's easier. The well-tempered region doesn't sound so good, and people,
okay.
the history of regions just doesn't sound so good. But the reality is you're completely right. You need regional systems. So, for example, if you want to connect a city to its food system, it's regional. To its water system, it's regional. It's so much of it is regional. So, and its transportation system are regional. So you're completely right. It's really the well-tempered region.
Interesting. Okay. Well, thank you so much. And this is a great conversation. It could keep on going. But, Fab, at this point, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much to both of you. Jonathan, I have a couple of questions for you that have come up for me while I've been listening here in the background. One is about, as you mentioned, there's a huge problem with wealth inequality in this country and many other countries. And you talk about whole systems needing to work together. And it strikes me that the main system that needs to work together is the economic system to support all this. And I'm wondering where all the funding ultimately comes from. Is it pure philanthropy, or is the government involved in at various levels to support these projects? Or does it vary according to region and city and so on?
So philanthropy, I think, is wonderful to seed change, but the global economy is far too big for philanthropy alone to shift. And I actually am a deep believer in the beneficent power of government to do good and to be the integrator. All the affordable housing projects that I do, one can only build affordable housing with government subsidy. The cost of housing is simply, the construction is too high and the income is too low. So we work a lot with, and there's no single program that can build affordable housing or provide health care, et cetera. We have to integrate many of them into our projects. My most complicated project had 23 sources of financing, and typically they'll have 6 to 12. Remember I was talking about the need for a circular systems. We need a circular economy. And I'll give you just a small example. Remember I was describing what we're doing with community-based health in our projects. We do a lot of work with not-for-profits, and we worked with the YWCA of White Plains to renovate a 90-year-old SRO for housing for women who are over 50, who are formerly homeless, many of them, or have very low-income jobs, minimum wage jobs, and often have both a physical and a mental health disability. The Y implemented a telemedicine program where twice a week the women's blood pressure, blood oxygen level, and pulse was measured. It went electronically off to doctors who analyzed it and sent back recommendations on diet, exercise, and medicine. That's actually where that diet, exercise, medicine idea first came from, is this program. And then there was a social worker on site who helped make sure the women, you know, improved their diet and exercise and took their medicine. The hospital emergency room admissions of that population got cut in half through that program. So now what we're actually working on, and we're doing this, we're about to launch a vast study with Harvard University's School of Public Health, Columbia University's School of Public Health, and Dartmouth, is a study to actually try and capture, to track, to measure the benefits of these on-site health programs we're generating, and to not only show what works and what doesn't in terms of improving people's health, but to see where are the systemic savings. And our belief is that if we can show that there's systems-wide savings that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars per project to the local healthcare system, and maybe even more, could we then develop a shared savings program where those savings actually are used to pay for the health system on in our projects? So it's taking the circularity concept and tying the pieces together.
Well, that sounds very productive.
So can I give you another example?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. So, for example, in the greening of our buildings, what we have found is that we can do almost all the energy-saving things that I described with a payback of less than 5 years. A five-year payback is a 20% return on investment. So if we can borrow money at 3 or 4%, and which you can with a mortgage, and get a payback at 20%, the difference is actually a positive economics to us, which we can then use to help fund the non-toxic parts of our greening programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly makes sense. I have another question related to, the control aspect of all this in terms of creating these other controlled communities where everything seems to be running more efficiently in terms of the social systems, the greening of an environmental responsibility, and so on. I'm wondering, in doing that, how much integration does it have? Because, you know, there is interdependence between all systems, between all socioeconomic classes. Are we creating more silos? Are we creating more communities that are just better and are still isolated from the general population? Are we still stuck with a system where there's great inequality ultimately, and we're just making the best of a bad situation?
So there's a couple parts to that question. So the first one, in terms of control, is that, you know, what's amazing is Paul Hawken notes that nature completely knows how to heal itself. If there's a forest fire, the first come back the woody plants and weeds, and then small bushes and thorns, and then small trees and larger trees. And, you know, like, it completely knows how to do that without anybody apparently being in control. So unfortunately, we humans need control system, but we also need, and I think this is really one of the core principles of service space, is, you know, we also need to each individually act in our own way, but in a coherent relationship to the whole. So individual service that is improvising and that is responsive to the moment is also as critical as having a kind of more of a master plan. We really need to actually balance that coherence and individual reality and responsibility. My goal is that should be equally spread everywhere. And you may have noticed the place I'm working on it is in low-income communities. So I actually hope. I'll tell you one more interesting thing. Because of enterprises' work, the greening of buildings has spread more in affordable housing than anywhere else. 75% of all new affordable housing built in America today is built to the enterprise green community standards. That's higher than new hospitals are built, than new schools are built, than even luxury housing. The highest penetration of green building is in affordable housing. Let's say that I think we can make the highest, in 10 years, my goal is that the highest penetration of these systems of opportunity are in affordable housing.
Wow.
So yes, I hope one day it'll spread to the wealthier neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here, and here we go. Go ahead.
Hi, Jonathan. This is David Crozier. Thank you so much for sharing today.
Hi, David.
Hi. I love the breadth of what you've shared, everything from 50-story buildings in Singapore is helping to helping empathetic social workers learn compassion instead. So it's really a breadth of topics that's refreshing. My questions are, in this country, are there any cities, whether large or small, that you've seen programmatically as a whole, try to make some strides with these things, as well as if there's any, we'll say, for-profit developers who have made some strides as well?
So, first of all, I'm a for-profit developer, and there are many others. There's a wonderful firm called McCormick Barron, which is based in St. Louis but works all over the country. There is, although it's a not-for-profit, it's very business-oriented in the Bay Area and throughout California, a group called Bridge Housing. And I am part of a wonderful community of for-profit developers actually all over the country. We work with an amazing, totally compassionate group of people, a small developer in Washington called Bridge Housing. Called Somerset Developers. So there's a whole ecology of us. And then the interesting thing about cities, I'm going to give you two examples. So first of all, I mentioned that Louisville, Kentucky, has chosen to be a compassionate city. And one of the interesting things that's in my book is that when the civil rights movement happened, rare among cities, and school busing was mandated in 1970, many, many communities were torn apart by that. And you see, for example, the destruction of Detroit because there was huge white flight because of that. So Louisville said, this goes back to the earlier point about regions, we're all in it together. And they combined the city and county school systems so you couldn't move to the suburbs to get out of the integration. And once everybody realized they're all in it together, then they had to commit to make every school equally great. And they did. They've really vastly improved the school system. When I was there, I visited an inner city school that had been one of the worst schools, you know, pre-1970 around. It was called Manual High School. It was actually, you know, didn't train people to go to college. It trained them for technical skills. And now it's literally one of the 10 best high schools in America. So that's the Louisville story. So now I'm going to tell you the Oklahoma City story. And I'm purposely not telling you about Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and places where you would expect. In Oklahoma City, about 15 years ago, a guy becomes mayor. And the next day, his chief of staff comes in and says, "Hey, boss, look at this. Men's Health magazine has designated us as the fattest city in America. They had the fittest cities and the fattest cities." And he goes, "I didn't go through this whole election to become the mayor of the fattest city of America. How do I get out of this?" And the guy says, "Well, let me go do some research." And he comes back and he says, "Well, it turns out what you need to be is a walkable community. When people walk, their weight goes down. How do you become a walkable community? We have to put sidewalks and street trees and things that attract people." So they put together a plan. They issued a bond issue that raised the sales tax, and the people of Oklahoma City voted to increase their taxes, to improve their city, to make it more walkable, to put a library downtown and some other things. They executed with the best architects, did it really beautifully, and it passed. And so then the businessmen came to the mayor and said, "You know, Oklahoma City is so boring. Our kids go off to college, and they never come back. And, you know, what are we going to do to bring them back?" So they go do research, and they say, "You got to be hipper, and you got to have arts and film and generative spaces." And so they rezoned all their loft areas and created a film and media district and a entertainment district. And again, they issued a bond issue, and people again increased their sales taxes to pay for it and created this really hip, generative space. And this goes on and on. Then they said, "We got too much traffic," and they issued a bond issue for mass transit and to create a light rail system, and they've been building affordable housing along it. And they, you know, said, "Well, we got to put Oklahoma City on the map," and they created, they took the local river and they turned it into a world-class place where you actually train to compete for kayaking events for the Olympics and stuff. And they've been doing that. They've been taxing themselves. This is the most conservative state in America, the most anti-climate change state in America, and at least on its senators. And they've been taxing and doing this beautiful work that serves everybody.
Thank you for sharing about that. We're in a bubble and out here in Oklahoma City. You know, these are high ROI type of things, both socially and economically. In the Bay Area, we have some unique challenges where we know we should act as a region, but we don't, and everyone pushes their housing requirement off. So we have an acute and chronic housing supply problem, and we care about our environment, and we really seem to be stuck trying to deal with our housing crisis. Do you have any thoughts on how a region, on the positive, protects its environment, but on the negative doesn't act as a region and take care of enough housing for its people?
I do. I've actually spent quite a bit of time in the Bay Area thinking and looking at this. And so the first thing is that one of the effects of the affordable housing issue is that it pushes people farther and farther away, and they have to drive more and more. So pollution and traffic are a deep consequence of not having housing jobs balance. And many of the wealthiest communities, including San Francisco and Palo Alto, Menlo Park, and that whole region, et cetera, have lower density zoning than is appropriate for their economic activity and their level of jobs. And they also have zoning that deeply discourages affordable housing. And in San Francisco, for a variety of reasons that are all about political correctness, San Francisco, a new affordable housing unit costs about $750,000 to build, which is, by the way, it's about $420,000 in New York, almost twice as much as New York to build a new affordable housing unit in San Francisco. And my understanding is it takes 5 to 7 years to get approved. And so, and part of it is because the city requires union labor and requires 1% for arts and requires this and requires that. And there's and so it takes a complete shift of community will. Every community has to agree to accept its fair share of affordable housing. Now, what's interesting is that a lot of really crummy affordable housing was built in the 60s and 70s and 50s and even early 80s. And there's a valid reason why people do not want concentrated poverty and slums in their community. It's completely understandable. But in the last 15, 20 years, there's been amazing green, net zero, beautiful, mixed income, gardened, affordable housing building. I mean, we build buildings that, win global architectural awards, and that, you look at them and any community would want to have them in their communities. So what communities need to do is to designate land, to actually identify sites where higher density affordable housing can be, to work with developers to really have it beautiful, to have it mixed income, to have it safe, to have it, but it has to be built. And interestingly, the other thing is that people think that affordable housing serves the homeless and kind of undesirables. In fact, it serves our parents who are retiring and living on Social Security. It serves our children who are getting out of high school or college and can't afford to live with their first job. It serves the cops and firemen who deal with it. It serves the school. It's a very interesting question you ask. Are you willing to let your kids be with a school teacher and school aides all day? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Are you willing to live next door to them at night? We should be able to. So every community, I believe, has a fair share responsibility to designate land that can be developed for affordable housing in balance with the needs of that specific community.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to read an online submission here. And for other listeners out there, if you want to submit something online, ask@servicespace.org. The live question from this forum is, you outline a beautiful conception, from Boston, by the way, you outline a beautiful conception of harmonious cities. So much of the trauma facing our country today is the growing divide between urban and rural areas in America, growing rural poverty and helplessness, as well as, some would argue, the dislocation and disconnection from place-based identity that comes from migration to cities, notwithstanding perhaps the material improvement in the lots of such urban migrants. I wonder how your view of a well-tempered city honors rural areas outside of just the country unit. So, for example, bridging the upstate-downstate divide in New York, politically, spiritually, and economically.
That is a great question, and I actually think the question itself has the seeds of the answer. So, you know, if we say we're going to equalize the landscape of opportunity for all, then that really means all, and it means all and where they live. And so absolutely rural communities need support. And interestingly, there is Americans move at about half the rate that they used to. So it used to be, you know, that people were very, very mobile, were less mobile. And one of the reasons is that many rural people can't move because either they have deep love of their place and they live there multi-generations, but also they are taking care of their elderly parents, or they are taking care of the family farm, et cetera. They are deeply rooted to place. And so first of all, one of the lessons of civilization is that civilization, people thrive with connectivity. If you go to Switzerland, it's amazing. They have a train system that almost goes to the farmhouse level. I mean, you can take a train in the mountains and in the rural areas to every little cluster. Those people are connected, you know, they're connected to markets, they're connected to ideas, they're connected to education systems, but those are very rural villages. So both from internet access, you know, data connectivity and physical connectivity, we need to do a much better job with our rural communities. We need to do a much better job distributing education. And just as I began to describe some urban systems of sustainability, there are many rural systems of sustainability. I mean, those are places that community solar, for example, really works. And again, these are things, they're not just hippie ideas, that when you take a lower-income family and you eliminate their electric bill and release $90 or $120 or $150 a month back into their economy, that makes a huge difference. So we, by the way, the new tax bill, not the tax bill, the current administration to pay for what they, the aid they claim they're going to bring to Houston and Puerto Rico, have announced that they're going to take part of the money out of rural electrification. And so we need actually to grow programs to serve these areas and to help them serve themselves. The political divide, all the political divides come from people feeling that the system doesn't care about them. And you know what? They're usually right.
Unfortunately. We have another caller.
Hi, thank you so much for an incredibly thoughtful conception you have, the work you're doing in the world. It's obviously, very deeply considered. The question I have for you, I was struck by a comment you made early in the call where you talked about the effects of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution in terms of breaking down tasks, like in cities. We have different city departments to deal with all kinds of things. I mean, I'm sure as a New York City developer, you're used to dealing with cities that are often dysfunctional in some ways. And I'm just wondering, kind of moving from theory to practice in your experience, how do you work with these kinds of divided systems and more generally, how in your conception would we put the genie back in the bottle? How do we move to more integrated views of public policy in very large cities like that?
Thanks. Great. So first of all, by the way, New York City is one of the, people don't understand this, but New York City is one of the easiest places to work. So we work all over the country. In most other cities, in New York City is one of the few cities where you can build what's called as of right. If you're doing a building within the zoning code, you can just go get a building permit. In other cities, you have to get site plan approval and Department of Water approval, all kinds of complicated approvals to be able to develop. It actually happens to be easier in New York. So it goes to multiple levels. The first thing is we need a vision. And I think cities need a 2050 vision. And the best people to do that are citizen groups. The greatest plans of the 20th century, like the Burnham Plan of Chicago, was done by independent groups. The Portland Sustainability Institute did a plan for its city. Happens Boston is doing something called Imagine 2030. It's a pretty good plan done by the city, but very often you see independent groups. The Regional Plan Association in a week is releasing a plan for the New York metropolitan region. There's an organization in the Bay Area, I don't know where you're based, called SPUR, that does regional and city planning. So I think we need to establish a vision. And then what we need is there's a thing called community health indicators. And these measure all kinds of elements of how cities are functioning or regions are functioning. They can measure traffic. They can measure pollution. They can measure carbon dioxide. They can measure how well kids are doing in school. They can measure different aspects of health. They can measure participation in civic life. They can measure degree of parks and walkability. Anyway, you can measure hundreds and hundreds of things. And we have the big data now that we can do that. So you want to take your vision and then figure out what are the measurements, and then cities need to move. Cities have the following tools. They regulate, like with building codes and zoning codes. They invest with infrastructure, building transit systems or water and sewer systems, whatever. They incent with tax breaks and other. They create incentives that encourage people to do things. And they also have leadership. You know, the leaders of great cities, like the one I described in Oklahoma City, had a vision. Like the leaders of, there are two very specific leaders in Louisville that kind of led them to integrate their school systems. Those tools, you can use those tools in a much more dynamic way. We tend to be very static. We create a 20-year plan or a 10-year plan or whatever. They have to be very dynamic and continually adjusting those tools of regulation and incentives and investments and leadership to have the community health indicators, which you're always watching, move you closer towards your vision. And then there needs to be a feedback system, and this needs to go on. So anyway, to me, that's the methodology. We can actually use big data and information to kind of tell us holistically where we are, and then even if we have to move the tools in pieces, we can judge their systemic effects.
Great. I think we have time for one more call, and that would be Wendy. Wendy, are you still with us?
Yes. I've got to, first of all, thank you so much for this very fascinating conversation. I've got a very brief comment and a question. My comment is that I remember many, many, many years ago in nursing school how I was part of a study where they were trying to teach nursing students to have empathy, and thinking about how I think learning compassion instead would be very helpful in terms of preventing huge amounts of burnout. So that's my comment. My question is my own experiences. I'm a native New Yorker, and when I was in my 30s, I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, lived in San Francisco, then Oakland, and now a very small community out on the coast, very low dense. And sometimes I wonder, how would I be able to integrate myself back into a high-density situation, a bigger city? And so I'm wondering, when you say a lot of people, or the trend is to move from the more rural or suburban areas back into cities, what is the key to helping people to live in high-density situations and integrate in high-density situations, both psychologically and other ways? How do people do that, live so close together and live in such a dense area?
I think the key is, there are two keys. Then the first has to be nature. You know, there's an area in New York City called Battery Park City, which is a fantastic place to live, which has high-density buildings that face onto a wonderful park that faces the river that has all kinds of great things for kids and families and just nature and bike paths and play areas and so the buildings are dense, but the place is just a thriving, you know, but there's the densities match with nature. I think that's number one. And number two, there, you know, we are social beings. People actually do gravitate to other people, and particularly when other people are living in joy. And so we need to create, when there's healthy systems. So again, I'm going to go back to Battery Park City. There are two great public schools there that, you know, so families there, they can walk to school. The parents are very involved in the PTAs and other school functions, et cetera. Some of them are very traditional social systems like PTAs. Some are new ones that are emerging. But, you know, people actually love to community garden together and to play music together and to, you know, do those things, and so communities need that social fabric also.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. So we'll start to wind things down here, and I want to ask one final question about You say that there is no static end state, and that is, of course, true. And we do need to remain practically grounded and also rise to the level of our aspirations, ultimately. And so I'm wondering, what is your aspiration? What is your theoretical end state? What are we working towards here?
So we're really working towards communities that are dynamically resilient, that can adapt, that have built the inherent adaptive capacity so that they can ride through the great disruptions that I see that we have created by population growth, overconsumption, and climate change, and income inequality. And there are places that are ever moving towards more environmental, social, human, and spiritual health. And there are places that are doing that in a way that equalizes the landscape of opportunity for all, so that every human being has an opportunity to thrive and be part of a better integrated whole.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. It's been a very informative call. I look forward to learning more about all these ideas of coherence, circularity, resiliency, community. And I'm going to think long and hard for myself about this idea of empathy versus compassion. And I think that's a very important piece of the puzzle here in all of us who are working to serve others. And so on that note, I'm wondering how the folks here at Service Space can support the work that you do.
I think, you know, I really appreciate you so much, Arya, and Service Space for having me on today. And also, I really appreciate everybody who listened in, because in a way, what I understand of Service Space is it's really the collective of all of you who are the listeners and the doers. And so take these ideas. They're described in much more detail in my book, but there are other places to find them too. And then that's what I love about this community, is I think you are already trying to live it in your lives and in the world and be the spreaders of good. And if the ideas in the book can help you do that in a more effective way, I'd be very grateful for that.
Okay, wonderful. And so we will wind things down just as we started here with a minute of silence, and we'll come back and after that minute and share some gratitude. So 1 minute of silence. Okay, so once again, thank you so much, Jonathan Rose, and I will shortly unmute all the lines so that we can say a collective thank you. And so thank you, Jonathan.
Okay.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.